say thank you to my Colombian colleague who's kept the door open with her foot.
Yeah.
Very good. You must have a sore hamstring. Closing. All right. My name is Michael Emery, and I work for the UN Population Fund. Come in. A couple of seats there. I'm going to give you a little bit of the corporate spiel to start with, because we have to. And the reason we have to is because nobody knows UNFPA, so we have to sort of describe ourselves a little bit first, except for, of course, my colleague who's the head of HR, the International Maritime Organization, and Eva, who's done an internship with us. So they know the business. Then I'm going to go into a much more general presentation about how do you get a job in an international organization. What are the different things you have to think about? Because it's tough now. It's really tough. And then hopefully we'll have 20 or so minutes for questions and stuff afterwards. All right? So before I get started, though, is there any one burning question that is not individualized that somebody wants to know the answer to? So I can address it during the presentation. No? Good. So, a little bit about UNFPA. The reason we exist is because the world's population is getting bigger. When my grandmother was born, there were 1.5 billion people on Earth. Now there's over 7 billion people. So it's one thing about our mandate, it's getting bigger every day. What do we do at UNFPA? Very interesting and somewhat different type of organisation in the UN. For a start, we have orange as our colour. Everyone else has blue. Okay, so you remember us with orange. We want a world where every pregnancy is wanted. So universal access to family planning. We want a world where every childbirth is safe. This is interesting. If you go into labour in the UK today, you have a 1 in 20,000 chance of dying giving birth. If you go into labour in Afghanistan, you have a 1 in 200 chance of dying. In Chad, a 1 in 100 chance of dying. If you go into labour in South Sudan, you have a 1 in 50 chance of dying. In fact, it's very common that South Sudanese women make their will before they deliver, because that's how common maternal death is. It's also one of the most preventable causes of death in the world. And we also want a world where every young person's potential is fulfilled. Now, in my mind, that's a really cool mandate, and I am very proud to work for UNFPA. So what do? We leverage population data to reduce poverty, promote universal access to family planning. We're the world's second biggest procurer of condoms, for example. You might say, who's the world's first biggest procurer?
First.
The US government. Which is interesting. A lot of people wouldn't pick that. And I think some of you have got some of our giveaways. Hands up those who've got the giveaway. Oh, no, you don't put those in. And that's the reason why we give them away, actually, by the way, is because we want people to know our website. And also we want to sort of break down the taboos and the barriers. A couple of seats at the front here. About talking about condoms and access to family planning. We work to support national health systems so that every birth can be safe. It's interesting, I was travelling recently with my colleague who's head of the Japanese office, and before that she was in Nepal. And within a space of 4 years, they had reduced the maternal mortality rate in Nepal from 900 to 400 in 4 years. And that's just by training community health workers in basic midwifery skills and getting them out into communities. So it's an incredible mandate. We want a world where every young person can reach their potential and is free of HIV and AIDS. So we're doing a lot of work around youth and sexuality and health education for youth and sexual and reproductive rights in particular. We want a world where every girl and woman is treated with dignity and respect. We do a lot of work on mitigating against child marriage. If you are married before the age of 18, you are 5 times more likely to die in childhood. Okay, so that's why there's a very poignant health reason why we do this. We have a couple of seats at the front. So. And we also have a niche area, or niche sort of role in humanitarian responses as well. I was in a UNFPA clinic in the Al-Zatari refugee camp for Syrians in Jordan recently, where they're delivering 7 babies a day there. It's quite special. Who we are, 2,500 basically now staff members.
about 300 of them in New York. We work in 150 countries. We have a very good balanced workforce, about 50-50 male, female, north-south. So the good news for us is that men are wanted in UNFPA. A lot of organisations in the UN, they're trying to promote women, etc. So if you're a woman, you need to think about that, by the way. If you're a woman, you want a job in the UN, go for peacekeeping. Only 21% of professional staff in peacekeeping are women. Also, if you're looking for a husband, it's a good place to work as well. As I say, the odds are good, but the goods are odd. In terms of different profiles that we're looking for, population development, reproductive health, maternal health, midwifery, health economics, gender, these are all what we call the substantive areas. We also have the sort of the less sexy areas as well, human resources, finance, accounting, audit, IT, etc. So if you've got any of those profiles, we kind of need you. Okay, you want to come up the front, there's a couple of chairs at the front. You'll move down there. We have different entry points into UNFPA, external vacancy service contracts, volunteers. Anybody here heard of UN volunteers? Okay, great organisation, we have about 100 of them in the field. The JPO program, so those of you who are from countries that support JPOs, I'm very happy to know that the UK is again going to be sponsoring JPOs next year, as of next year, which is good. Switzerland as well, which is the coming up. Like every part of the UN system, we have a website, a dedicated website for jobs. There is no one go-to website for the UN. Every organisation has its own website, so you must go to ours. And we have lots of pictures of beautiful women on our website. This one, these are actually our staff. And it's funny when you run into her in the elevator, I say, you're Miss UNFPA. Okay, so that's the corporate spiel. Now, we're getting into the interesting part. And this is the section on how do you actually get a job in international organisations. And to set that context, I need to show you a YouTube video which looks at how the world of work is fundamentally changing. Now, hands up those who've seen this presentation before. One person. Okay, that's good. So there's a thing there that says we are living in exponential times, and we are. The world of work is changing rapidly. And certainly in the private sector, public sector to some extent, but certainly in the multilateral sector as well. So what I'm going to do now is talk about the different elements you need to think about if you are wanting to access a career in the international sector. It's also very relevant to the private sector, public sector, military sector, etc. as well. So a couple of quick ones. Firstly, qualifications. The UN is fairly hung up on qualifications. In my own organisation, we say minimum is a master's. Okay? So a piece of advice, if you wanted to work for the UN, try and get a master's at least. Some organisations, secretariat, don't require a master's, but you are competing against tens of thousands of people that are being churned out of fantastic graduate schools every year. And I mean tens of thousands. I was in Korea a couple of years ago at Yonsei University, and the first secretary of the Korean mission in New York said to me, will you give a presentation on how to prepare for a competency interview to the students at Yonsei? And I said, yeah, sure, no problem. How many materials? You know, like 30, 40. He said 1,500. And that was in an auditorium with 1,500 people who were doing international relations, studying it in English, and all wanting to work for the UN. And this is what we're competing against. So, if you haven't got the masters, really to be competitive, you need to be thinking about that. Okay? A lot of people think, oh, I have the energy, I have the money for that. Everybody has said, just take a punt and do it. You can normally knock it off in sort of 20 months when you look at the academic years. It's 20 months hard in your life, but it's worth it. Nobody looks back after that. You also need a good set of documents. Now, the UN is interesting. We are supposed to be one UN, but we all ask for different things in our applications. The secretariat wants a personal history profile. What do you have in IMO? Same. We have the e-recruit P11 personal history form. They're all fairly similar, but my advice to you is give people what they want. If they want an achievement-oriented CV, take the time to give them an achievement-oriented CV. What do they have at IMF there?
Similar.
Similar, okay. It's interesting, I get applications at UNFPA and it says, career goal, I really want to work for the IMF. Well, I'm curious, well, why are you applying for a job at UNFPA then? They haven't taken the time to change an application. You really do have to tailor an application and give the employer what they want. We have a philosophy that if you're lazy on your application, you'll be lazy in the job. And I remember people ringing me up saying, why wasn't I shortlisted for this job? So I go back and look at their application, and they have like a one-liner on their CV, like, please see attached, and that's it. They haven't taken the time to do a proper application. Be aware of spelling errors, too, simple things. I remember I received a CV, a Harvard CV. Anybody here been to Harvard, Harvard University? Now, they have their own sort of special one- or two-page resume, and this lady had 7 years of experience in pubic administration. And obviously the spell check hadn't picked it up. So I ran here actually and said, are you aware that you've got this mistake on your CV? And she was absolutely mortified. She said, well, at least it captured your attention. Many organisations now are also doing keyword searches. So you need to be clever about how you weave in the competencies from the vacancy notice into your application. I did this one organisation once where we wanted a training officer. We were trialing this. And we put in the word training, learning, education, career development, capacity building. So sort of five key phrases. Pressed the button, and we went from 900 applications to less than 200. So over 700 people didn't have any of those terms in their electronic resume at all. Was screened out. Okay? So you really have to be crafty about what you weave into your application. We often ask for cover letters as well. Now, interesting, the worst candidates say see attached, okay, that means they're lazy. The best candidates, the most candidates regurgitate their CV. Yeah, as you'll see from my curriculum vitae, I did X, Y, and Z. Okay, we know that because we've seen your CV. The good candidates bring in the value proposition that they can bring to the organisation. What is your added value to the organisation? What can you bring to IMF, ILO, UNFPA, UNDP, Secretary? What can you bring? And they're the ones that actually capture our attention, the ones that talk about the value proposition. We know that. Most people in this room, the thing I like about this room is there's a sort of an average age over 30, which is kind of cool, because you're much more employable. But you probably know all about these two first things. Now, the next one is an interesting one. And normally when I show this in a multicultural group like this, it's this sort of collective sigh. Okay. Network. See, so nobody sighs now because I tell them not to do it. Now, networking, interesting. It's described as building long-term professional, reciprocal relationships where you're sharing knowledge, resources, and information. So the key word there is reciprocal. I would argue very strongly that everybody in this room has incredibly powerful information that they can share with other people in this room, if you've got to know each other well. Okay. Why is it important? Because 90% of jobs in any sector is secured through some form of formal or informal network. Now, there's this image that networking is kind of a North American thing. You know, take the boss out for lunch. When the check comes, I know, let me get this one. And sort of slip the resume across the table. No, that's called a bribe. Yeah. It's not. Every society that has ever existed has had formal and informal mechanisms for networking. Yeah, about sharing information, etc., alerting people to opportunities. Now, we tend to talk about three tiers of networkers in the UN. We talk about tier three, that's 70% of us, who are passive networkers. We do have a couple of chairs at the front if people want to come and actually have a seat. It might be a bit more comfortable. So, you want to come at the front here? We've got two chairs up here. Yeah. So tier three are what we call passive networkers. These are people that come to work, they turn their computer on, they do a good job, they go for lunch, come back, make a few calls, turn the computer off at 5, go home, and they basically do okay in the organisation. They put in the minimum amount in order to get paid and to get praised nicely. That's about 70% of people. About 28% of people are what we call active networkers. And these are people that do things like set up the Christmas decorations, take them down in February. Mm-hmm. They send out Christmas cards. They remember people's birthdays and they bake them a cake or bring a cake in. They stay late when there's a crisis. They volunteer to take minutes in meetings. They take the new staff member under their wing and show them around. They look out for people in the organisation. They put much more in than they take out of an organisation. They get noticed and they get promoted and their careers move more quickly than other people. And tier one are what we call creative networkers. These are people that actually create networks of people. They set up think tanks, roundtables, NGOs, conferences. They have an idea, and they generate resources behind that idea. They move an agenda forward, and they bring people along with them for the ride. Okay? A lot of inspirational leaders fall into this category. These people move extraordinarily rapidly in organizations. So think about that paradigm, tier one, tier two, tier three. Think about where you are in that paradigm at the moment. If you're sort of navigating predominantly in tier three, you are doing your career a disservice. Okay, because there's a lot of people that are navigating in tier two and tier one. So think about that. Now I'm going to give you some very specific pieces of advice here on networking. Firstly, this is one my grandmother gave me. Now, my grandmother was a remarkable woman. She was a Lebanese migrant to Australia, and she was totally illiterate. And she compensated for her illiteracy in many ways. So one of the ways that she used to do it, and she used to tell me this, she says, Michael, you should invest in conversations with people because it's always harder to say no to somebody that you've met. And it's a very, very wise piece of advice. We are living in a very interesting technological age. You saw it on there on the presentation. I think we are losing the art of conversing. And I would argue very strongly that you need to do less on Facebook and LinkedIn an email and get out and talk to people. Okay? It's interesting that you might actually learn something interesting that way. The other thing is that if you offer to take an interview on the phone, ask them if you can do it in person. Statistically, you're more likely to get the job if you do it in person because it's harder to say no to somebody that you can connect with. Okay? So, very strong piece of advice. Hands up those who are still at university here. People. Second piece of advice for the university students. Okay? Put down the books and pick up a glass of wine. Why? You say, why? We've got a few recruiters in the room. Maha, you've done recruitment, haven't you? Maha works at the secretariat. Have you done recruitment at IMF? You've done recruitment. Have you ever looked at the scores people got in their master's degrees before you recruit them? Never. Never. You see, we're doing the recruitment. We don't look at the scores. We only want to know that you passed. So you're much more likely to get a job by actually talking to somebody and socialising with them and learning about them and being interested in them and them being interested in you than by sitting down, beavering away, getting a top score in an exam. Okay, so I don't mean sort of, you know, go out drinking all night because that's not good for your body. Find a balance. Okay? Find a balance between the social side of university and getting the right numbers. Okay? It makes a difference. Think about these things. Think about where you network. Hands up those who work in an office here. Okay, you'd be very curious to know that most of your interaction, about 75% of your daily interaction, is within 25 metres of your desk. So break out of the 25 metre zone. Don't send an email. Don't put it through the inter-office courier for the floor below you. Actually go and deliver it and have a chat to the person. Do stuff. Think about how you network. Interesting. I used to have a job in peacekeeping where people had the misconception that I could get them jobs. I've never been able to get anybody a job in my life. And I have people come into my office, never seen them before. Usually unannounced, so no appointment. And they come in and say, oh, Mr. Remy, how are you? I say, oh, hi, how are you? And I say, here's a gift from my country. Okay, so how do I feel about that? Somebody I've never met before, they give me
wooden giraffe or a bag of coffee or something like that. He's
saying in your head, what do you want?
That's what I might be saying in my head. What else might I be saying?
No?
Well, it depends if it's a Swiss watch. I thought, oh, yeah. A sense of expectation, bribe even, feeling guilty about the person. Thanks, I'll take it back. It's interesting that they always take it. The person in the front row always takes the thing. I don't know.
Trying to get a job there.
And it's interesting because in many cultures, it's actually quite rude to come in and see somebody and not offer a token of appreciation. So that gives you an idea of the cross-cultural nuances of networking. And you have to be cognizant of that, particularly in the multilateral sector. Okay? Because you are dealing with a lot of cross-cultural issues there. So think about how you network. That's also interesting. Some people feel very comfortable coming in and just talking about themselves. Other people do it in a more subtle way. So I remember I served in East Timor for 3 years. And this is even before I knew about networking. If anyone knows about the context in East Timor, there was nothing to do in the evenings in East Timor. The place was burnt down. It was unsafe to go out at night, so people would just basically lock themselves in their houses or their apartments, and then the power would go out. And so it was kind of, you know, pretty boring. So I used to cook. I love cooking. And I used to invite 12 people over for dinner sort of 3 or 4 times a week and just have a big dinner. And it was a staggeringly good avenue for networking, even though I didn't know it, because in a social scene, getting to know people, getting to know what made them laugh and what they were anxious about and what they were good at and stuff, it was just really interesting. And I still come across people today that talk about the chocolate puddings they used to make with no power in any scene. So think about ways of networking that you feel comfortable with, but don't not pay attention to it, because you're doing your career a disservice if you're not. Think about when you network. I used to be at UNDP. I was head of recruitment at UNDP. And people come to my office, say, "Oh, Mr. Irwin, how are you?" I said, "Hi, how are you?" And they say, "Yeah, look, my contract's finishing today. I thought I'd better come and see you and do some networking." Leaving the last minute. Think about with whom you network. Interesting one. Most of us tend to hang out with the same sort of 7 or 8 people. We have lunch with them, we hang out with them at university, we go out with them in the evenings. Sometimes it's very family-centric. Break out of that group. Go and sit next to somebody that you don't even know and strike up a conversation with them in the lunchroom. Chances are you'll find out something really interesting about them. And they will find out something really interesting about you. And you never know when that, and we had this in a, we had a conference yesterday, by the way, which is why we're here today, and there was a presentation at that conference called Planned Happenstance. Okay, so you actually orchestrate chance to happen for you. And if you're prepared to sort of take risks like that, you never know what's going to open up in front of you. Okay. And finally, think about why you network. This is an interesting one. A lot of people come and see me and say, can you teach me how to do networking so I can get a job? No. It's not that simple. There's no silver bullet for networking. At its very core, networking is about people. And basically, people are interesting. People are actually... That's why I like working in human resources. I do a lot of interviewing. I do find people's stories really interesting. And so I'm actually lucky that I like my job. But learn about, you know, sort of learn about people and put yourself, open yourself up to people. And the spin-off is that it's actually quite good for your career and for your job as well. Okay, so that's a really important one. If you're not paying enough attention to this, you're probably doing your career a disservice. It's never too early to start thinking about networking. As a young professional, you need to start thinking about building and nurturing and maintaining those professional relationships. Now, the next little person here, this is an interesting one. Everybody in this room has one. You're probably thinking, wow, what is this? You all have a reputation. Now, it's interesting, reputation. How other people see you is a tremendously powerful career driver. Tremendously powerful. Most people have what we call a one line associated with them. Yeah, great guy, really flexible, like to work with him. Yeah, she's really analytical, she works hard, I'd love to have her on my team. That's the one liner associated with you. I know this because I ring people up and do reference checks on people. Okay. It's interesting, I did one for a very senior position at UNDP once, and we were considering this guy, and I said to somebody, what's he like? I rang one of his staff from a previous job. I said, what's he really like? And she said to me, look, he's really good. I mean, substantively, he knows his stuff. He's really good. But when he gets angry, he throws telephones at people. It's a curious red flag. So I did a bit more homework. And consistently, I got this message. Really good at what he does, but a bit of an anger management issue. Now, I didn't want to recruit a staff member with an anger management issue. I have enough problems dealing with the existing staff I have without bringing on new problems. So how other people see you is really important. Now, it's not what you think other people think about you. That's not what your reputation is. Your reputation is what other people think about you. And sometimes people have no idea what their reputation is. It's very easy to ruin a reputation with one dumb incident, one dumb email, one dumb drunken episode at the Christmas party. Anyone in the Christmas season, where you wake up and go, oh my God, what have I done? Anyone seen Bridget Jones's Diary? Okay. Classic Christmas party scene where she ruins her reputation. The email, and this is another piece of advice I'm going to give you, a third piece of advice. Never send an angry email. Close the computer, save as a draft, go home, have a glass of wine, and look at it with fresh eyes in the morning. Okay, if you send, I get these as the head of human resources, I get them. I get an email from an angry staff member who decides to copy the world. Just copy the world. I'm going to show what an idiot my boss is. I'm going to copy the world. Okay, what are you doing? You're ruining your reputation. You're showing, hey, you're not coping. You're not the sort of person that decelerates issues. You're the sort of person that's accelerating issues. That's making you look foolish. Classic. If you've got a classic story. We had a special assistant to the special representative of the Secretary General in the Peace Commission. He decides to write an email to his girlfriend. So the first half of the email, he talks about what an idiot his boss is. The second half of the email, he talks about what he'd like to be doing with her that evening. Believe me, it's a cracker of an email. He accidentally sends it to the entire mission. His surname started with Al, so it went to all. Yeah. Now, can you imagine that sinking feeling as the out-of-box email starts coming back? Why do I do that? I mean, oh my God. Next day, the boss called him in and said, thank you, very entertaining email. I really enjoyed that one. I'm not going to ask you for your resignation because I know that you're going to give it to me. And true. That's it. End of story. Go on. So, email, use of email, a very powerful tool. Be careful with it, okay? Be really, really careful with it. So, how other people see you. Very important, particularly in the first 3 months of the job. Now, we talk about the theory of thin slices. Who's read Malcolm Gladwell's book called Blink? Anybody? Great book. And basically, the human brain is conditioned to walk into a room or a situation, look at the people there, and make a snap decision about them based on intuition and previous experience. Okay. Anybody here got children? Who's got a young child, sort of, you know, 6 to 8 months or anybody? No. Okay. If I had a young child here, it would be a girl, because girls are the future. If I was to clap her hands together, say a six-month-old girl, she wouldn't look at my hands, she'd look at my face. And if I was smiling at her, she'd give me a huge smile. And if I was frowning at her, her lip would start to quiver, and the tears would well up in the eyes, and she'd start to cry. And she's done exactly that. She's looked at me, she's decoded my emotions, and she's reacted accordingly. Now, we do that in situations all the time. When you walked into this room, you looked at me, you looked at the tie I was wearing, you looked at my haircut, you looked at my athletic physique, and you made a decision. Everyone laughs at that, I don't know why. And you made a judgment about me. You're probably thinking, wow, this boring bureaucrat from the UN is about to give a speech. I did exactly the same thing to all of you. I've thin-sliced a lot of you here already today, so I know which ones I'm going to employ. The ones that are laughing at my jokes. But we do that all the time. Now, you put that in an interview context, for example. you go into an interview, and there's a lot of evidence to suggest that a panel will make up their mind about you within 40 seconds, and sometimes as quick as 2 seconds. Okay? I remember working with a lady that had been downsized from a peacekeeping mission in Africa, and she was going for 2 jobs with the Public Information Service in New York. White Western woman. I was working with her on her interview technique. I said, after the first interview, she had 2 interviews. I said, after the first interview, come and let's have a debrief and see if we can do any lessons learned for the next interview. So she comes into my office, she's very upset, she's crying. I said, okay, how did it go? She said, it was all over in 15 minutes. Is that a good thing or is that a bad thing? I said, well, you know, it could be good, it could be bad. And meanwhile, I think, wow, 15 minutes, that's quick, they wanted you out of there. I said, look, I need to ask you this question. This is a white Western woman. I said, were you wearing that dress in the interview? She goes, yes, what's wrong with this dress? White Western woman wearing a beautiful African tie-dye dress. Bazam cotton stitching, magnificent. If you're in Africa, but not if you're going for a corporate job interview in New York City. I said, go to Macy's and buy yourself a blue suit for the next interview. She said, but that's not fair. They're not looking at me, they're looking at what I'm wearing. I said, you're right, it's not fair, but it's reality. So stick to, you know, be pragmatic and stick to the reality, because you got the next job. So think about things like that. The way that people see you first up can be very, very powerful. I had a young professional I recruited. We sent him to a country office. The first thing he did was organise a local staff union to challenge the resident coordinator of the office. Bad move. Okay? He's labelled as a troublemaker from day one. Might be right, yes, but be smart about it. So think about that. Think about how other people see you. Very important. Think about competencies. Now, there's probably 50 people in this room. If I was to ask you to write down the definition of competency, I would have anything ranging from a blank page to 3 or 4 pages, and everything would be completely different. People have a vague idea what a competency is. Very few people really understand how they fit in as a bedrock in human resources. How they fit into job analysis, job design, job classification, developing job specs, job interviewing, and job evaluation. If you want a comparative advantage over everybody else that is going for jobs, learn what a competency is, and take a course in competency interviewing. Those of you who are at university, your university will provide sort of courses in competency interviewing. Take the course. It's the most important course you'll take. Sometimes called situational interviewing, sometimes called behavioural interviewing. It is an art form. And I know a lot of excellent candidates that have bombed out in an interview because they just don't know how to do a proper interview. So that's something you can control. So control it. Take the course. Do a good interview. Think about your... Yes?
So just on the competences, in the UK Domestic Civil Service, we have a core competence framework, which applies across departments. Is there anything similar from multilateral organisations?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, every organisation will have a competency framework that is slightly tailored to their organisation. The Secretariat, for example, their core values, professionalism, integrity, and respect for diversity. So, and then there's teamwork, there's IT awareness, etc., etc. My organisation has an interesting competency, which we just introduced, which is courage. Because you do have to be courageous in many countries where we work, the Population Fund, to really take on and tackle the issues that we deal with. We deal with very sensitive and very, very controversial issues. So it's kind of an interesting competency that we have. But yeah, all you can do is just Google the organisation. Generally, you'll find it on their website. It's a good preparation for the interview. Job satisfiers. In a nutshell, these are things that make you happy when you come to work. If you think back to the different jobs you've had in your life, at some points you would have been really, really engaged and happy. At another point you would have been totally demotivated and think, I need a change. Now, if you actually think about the ingredients which made your job happy, chances are they will be your job satisfiers. And they can be lots of different things. Rarely, by the way, is it money. It can be, but rarely is it money. Normally, money ranks number 7 on what makes people happy. Normally, it's recognition for the work that they do. feeling empowered, feeling that they are current in their profession and their job. So these are the things that actually matter. Now, what I'll say, I won't say too much about job satisfiers, except work out what it is that makes you happy and try to navigate or gravitate towards those jobs and those careers. If you're the sort of person who really likes to work in the bush on development issues, on water and sanitation, don't take a job in headquarters. This is not like a bush in headquarters, I can tell you. It's more about elevators and stuff. If you're the sort of person who really likes to work on research and you don't really like to engage with other people, don't take a job where you have to be a team player and a team member. Take a job where you can work on research. If that's what makes you feel happy. So think that, work it out what it is that makes you happy. Similarly with values. Now, values are interesting. In a nutshell, values are the sort of things that are important to you. Everybody in this room has an individual value system. Okay? And our value system is shaped by the way that we are personality coded, the way that we are culturally coded, the way that the things that we have been exposed to, our critical incidents in life sometimes. Okay? These are the things that shape our values. Sometimes as a very young person, we see some chronic injustice, and that may shape our values. The fact that you're all here at a career fair for the multilateral sector, I think we would have a fairly strong value proposition in this room. Now again, often people don't really think about their values. I know this for a fact because I ask this question in interviews. This is the question. Tell me about the three values that are most important to you and how do these values translate into your work? I see you all thinking there now, how the hell would I answer that question in an interview? It's not because you don't have a value system, it's because you haven't taken the time to think about what's really important in your life. So do that tonight. Go home and have a glass of wine. That's your third glass, by the way, so no driving after that. And think about that question. It's actually a really interesting question. What are the three things that are really important to you? How do these transcend or translate into your life? I mean, it's quite an interesting question. Again, the challenge is to gravitate or to align your career and job choices to what's important for you. If you take a job where your value system is being compromised consistently, you are going to be unhappy, and your husband or your wife or your girlfriend or your boyfriend is also going to be really unhappy if you're unhappy. I can tell you that. Values and job satisfiers are different. I could be in a job where all of my job satisfiers are being met. But if it's for a company that produces landmines, I would have fundamentally compromised my own value system. Okay. So, we had an interesting one. We did a recruitment for a senior position in UNFPA recently, and one of the people that applied was the head of Rothmans cigarette company. And he actually had a very interesting profile for us. He had everything we needed in terms of competency fit. But an awkward conscience for an organisation that has a very strong health bent, I couldn't bring somebody in who'd worked their whole career for a cigarette company and what they were promoting. I just couldn't do it. So it was interesting. It was an interesting moral dilemma for myself to look at that. Well, it must have been another good presentation. The next one is opportunity scans. As that video showed, the world of work is changing fundamentally. That means there is new opportunities opening up all the time. There's also old opportunities closing. Maha, who's at the back of the room, and I used to work in peacekeeping together about a decade ago, and there used to be a category of staff called radio operators. Mm-hmm. Are there still radio operators, Maha? No. I think there were about 600 when I started. Now there's none. Okay, you don't need them. People use mobile phone these days. There are new opportunities opening up all the time. Anybody here an accountant? We love accountants, okay, in the UN. Why do we love accountants? Because the private sector pays a lot more than we do, so it's very hard for us to attract accountants into the UN. But there's a thing called IPSAS. Do you know what IPSAS is? My God, you're not a very good accountant. Okay. Do you know what IPSAS is? International Public Sector Accounting Standards. Okay. Every part of the UN system has had to move to be IPSAS compliant, and none of our existing staff had IPSAS qualifications. So in terms of opportunities, what's opening up, you know that if you've got Is that a football crowd? You know that if you've got excess in your profile, you're going to be very, very marketable. In my own organization, we need Lusophone candidates, Portuguese speakers. That's why we want to recruit Christian, who's from Brazil, you know, so he's got a good profile for us. We need people with really good youth backgrounds, particularly people that are good at working with marginalized youth. So if you've got that skill set, then you've got that entry point. A lot of organizations, particularly the ones that are voluntarily funded, and we're a voluntarily funded organization, are sensitive to nationality mix as well. We have a couple of chronically underrepresented nationalities. Anybody here Norwegian? Okay. Fifth piece of advice I have for you. If you're not married yet, marry a Norwegian. Great nationality to have to get a job in the UN system. Anybody here from Kiribati? No. Second piece of advice on marriage. Marry somebody from Kiribati, because Kiribati is the only country that is totally unrepresented in the entire UN system. So sometimes nationality counts. Sometimes gender counts. I talked about peacekeeping before. They need women. Okay, Secretariat needs women. IMO, do they need women?
Yeah.
IMO needs women. Okay. Not many women in shipping, is that right? What's your gender mix?
We're about 44% women.
That's not bad.
Yeah.
That's pretty good. 44% women, that's good. What about Secretariat?
32%
women. Ooh. IMF?
49.
45, are you getting there? Okay. Yeah. Good. So work out that. Also work out where there are some nationalities that are underrepresented in some organizations, but not others. Okay, so work that out. I don't have any Koreans at all in UNFPA. So if anybody's Korean here, any Koreans? Okay, if you know any Koreans, send them my way. Okay. Sometimes that matters. It's not a significant factor, but it's a variable. It's a variable that will sometimes push you over the line. Anybody here ever done voluntary service? VSO in particular? UNV? Okay, we love voluntary service. It's a big plus for us. It's sometimes the difference between getting on a shortlist and not getting on a shortlist, because with a volunteer track record, we see it as a really strong value proposition in Canada. So think about that. EQ. Now, I was devastated to learn yesterday that apparently there's no such thing as emotional intelligence. There is only cognitive intelligence. That's one perspective. EQ is emotional intelligence, and if we could sum that up in one word, it would be awareness. How aware are you of how you're culturally coded, how your personality coded, and how that influences other people around you? How do you influence people to action? How do you navigate conflict in a team? How do you resolve issues between yourself and a senior manager? How do you convince other people to come to your way of thinking? This is EQ. Some people comes naturally to them, some people have to work on it. When it comes down to jobs in international organizations, by the time you get to the interview, basically we've worked out that you can do the job. What we want to know is, can you integrate into the workforce, into the team? Can you be a team player? Can you fit into the culture of the organization? So again, if you haven't done any reading on emotional intelligence, probably about time you picked up a book. Okay, very important. Momentum. Some people apply for a job in UNFPA, we meet them 3 years later, say, yeah, I applied for a job, but I didn't get any response, so I gave up. Okay. In international organizations, we have a huge number of applicants. How many in the secretariat last year? Was it 250,000? About a million applicants. Okay. It does take time. Okay? It really does. We have constraints in that we have 193 member states who are looking over our recruitment processes and making sure that it's egalitarian. Okay? We're not nimble when it comes to recruitment. So just because you don't get the first job you apply for, don't give up. Sometimes it takes a number of years to access an organization. Sometimes they say, look, you need 7 years of experience, and you've only got four. So don't go out there and get another 4 years of experience and then come back and have a crack at it again. Okay? Look at momentum. Momentum's important in building anything with careers. You also, of course, have to be ready as well. And that's the last little bit there, which is luck. You do need a little bit of luck, but I like Oprah's definition of luck. And she says luck is when preparation meets opportunity. It's very true. What I'd argue very strongly is if you are addressing all of these things holistically, you are creating the conditions for luck to happen for you. There was Thomas Jefferson. He said, you know, it's funny, the harder I work, the luckier I get. And again, the same thing. So, this is what I've learned over 23 years in the multilateral sector. Colleagues from the multilateral sector in the room, anything to add to any of that? Because otherwise I'd like to hear other people's perspectives.
I think the fit between you and the organization is very important. Not all international organizations are the same. I'll give you an example on the structure first and then on the purpose. In terms of structure, for example, I work in the UN Secretariat and there are thousands of people like you, so the job tends to be very specialized. So if you like to be in a very specialized job, this is the kind of organization you should go. If you get bored with routine, go to a smaller organization, that's what I did. So the size of the organization does matter in terms of the type of jobs that you do.
So size does matter.
Inversely. and the mission, the meaning that it offers to your life. It is different to work, no criticism to the IMF, in the IMF and work at UNFPA or work at the World Food Programme. So you have to be aware of all these differences.
And there are. I've worked in the Secretariat, I've worked in peacekeeping, I've worked in UNDP, I've worked in the International Organization for Migration, I've worked in UNFPA, and they are all organizationally, culturally different. Mm-hmm. And some have better things than others, but they're all different. I actually feel very much at home in UNFPA. Mm-hmm.
Just to mention, that the view of my home is holistic, really gives you an insight on how to manage your career. That would be very my presentation, a great segue to that, because I'll give you the details, the nitty-gritty on how to, what options or venues would be available within the context of the UN Secretariat.
And that's a good presentation. I know that one off by heart, so I often travel with the Secretariat, so often we change and do each other's presentations. IMF, anything?
Specifically for ICON, but as an organization, we're looking primarily for economists, PhD in economics, cost, and we're particularly looking at education.
Good. Okay, questions from the floor?
Yeah. For UNFPA, the entry requirement, can you go straight from postgrad to 3 years? You need 2 years experience.
You need a minimum of 2 years experience. Our international positions start at P2. So we'd like at least 2 years of relevant experience. For younger people, we cut them a little bit of slack. As you get older, sort of in your sort of late 30s, mid-40s, we like to be very strict on what we regard as relevant experience. Remember when I was in UNDP once, somebody was arguing with me that 2 years of voluntary sheep shearing in New Zealand was relevant for a democratic governance position in Serbia. I said, no, that's a stretch. I'm not going to do that. It's interesting, like a lot of people do military service, for example. And people say, do you count military service? I said, if it's relevant, if you're doing air operations in the Israeli military and you're wanting a job in air operations in peacekeeping, yeah, it's entirely relevant. So you break it down in that way. Yep.
What about my career trajectory? So I think you've mentioned you've been in and out, say, four times.
Yeah.
Could you say something about how you can manage that career, perhaps moving between an in-out of UN bodies?
Sure. It's depending on the functional area, it can be a little bit easier. Now, I'm in human resources. And if I can do, I do human resources in UNDP, I can do it in UNFPA. I mean, it's virtually the same. That's easy. If you're in sexual and reproductive health, it's very difficult because there's not too many organisations that cover that. So it depends on what functional area you're in. If you're in IT, the world's your oyster. Okay, you can go anywhere. And we very much encourage mobility in the UN. And mobility in all senses, mobility, geographic mobility. I mean, Christian served in headquarters in Santiago in Chile, in London. I've been in four continents serving. Naha, you've been functionally mobile, and you started in Egypt, did you? Or,
no, but I started in
the
different part,
So we also talk about functional mobility as well. and so in some cases it's easier than others. So I had the luxury of leaving three times and going in four times. It's not that easy to do. So if you're a political scientist, for example, working in the Department of Political Affairs, if you leave, you've got 5,000 people waiting for your job, literally. So then it becomes a little bit more tricky. I would say it's a healthy thing to do, to come in and out and get different perspectives, to grow, to get a private sector perspective or a consulting perspective. I think increasingly there's recognition in the UN that's a good thing to do. It also depends on the timing as well. At the moment, it's not a particularly good time to be looking for a job in the UN. We have a number of organisations that are contracting. My organisation is actually expanding. We grew 10% last year in terms of the budget. So we're looking for stuff. So also in terms of the opportunity scams, look at the organisations that are growing. In fact, there's an expression, follow the money. Where money's flowing, there's jobs. So there's money flowing to sexual and reproductive health, there's jobs there. There's money flowing to Central African Republic, which there will be. In the next 3 months, there'll be jobs there. I can guarantee you now, if you land in Bungie, and you've got a pulse and you're half sensible, you can get a job. Okay. I'm serious. I mean, you might get shot as well, but you will certainly get a job before you're shot. So you have to use your opportunity scans, your networking, to work out how to navigate there. And again, there's no book you can go to or no website. You have to talk to people. Good question.
Actually, this is a little bit of a follow-up. Which is, I was curious about your example where you interviewed a senior executive from Brockman's proposed. And I guess what I'm interested in is what opportunities are there, what advice would you offer someone who's at a relatively senior level in their career, doesn't have the international experience, but is interested? And what would you be looking at? And I suppose I was asking that because I was wondering what got the Brockman's guy into the room.
What got him into the room was that it was a regional position and he had managed the region, so he had an intimate knowledge of the region and the language assets that we needed. And if you break down the actual vacancy notice and look at each competency, he had very, very well translated his present experience with the competencies he had in that job into the competencies that we were looking for that regional position. So that's one piece of advice I'd give you, is don't think of yourself as a series of jobs, think of yourself as a competency package. Okay. When I got the job as head of recruitment at UNDP, I'd never worked in recruitment. So how did I get that job? I think they're still asking the same question. I was able to successfully articulate that I've got all these other areas in human resources, so I understand the business. So I've seen recruitment from the other end, and I've got like a 90% competency fit for this position. Now, we do take a lot of people, particularly from the public sector. We just recruited our head of evaluation, and UNFPA, somebody that's never worked in the UN before, who's the head of evaluation at DFID. So, or number two in DFID, coming across to UNFPA. So certainly a public sector profile is a very, very useful one for us. But also private sector. I mean, you look at all the IT people, we generally take them from the private sector. A lot of our HR people now, we're taking private sector people. So it just depends on the area. Audit, accounting, finance, a lot of it's private sector. But even our own mandate, we do a lot on supply chain management. I mean, being a big supplier of condoms, we have to have a robust supply chain. So we need people with supply chain backgrounds as well. So people coming out of logistics, and the big logistics companies, TNT and so DHL, etc. They have good profiles. Right. Let me spot on 12 o'clock. It's startlingly hot in here. You've been a very interesting crowd. Thank you very much. Hope to see you in the UN at some point.